Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, apologized this afternoon for what many saw as anti-Semitic comments discussing links between AIPAC and other Zionist lobbying efforts and money with American policy output. She tweeted, GOP leader Kevin McCarthy threatens punishment for @Ilhan MM and Rashida Tlaib over their criticisms of Israel. It's stunning how much time U.S. political leaders spend defending a foreign nation, even if it means attacking free speech rights of Americans. When people asked what Omar meant, Kevin McCarthy had pushed back on this, and when people asked what Omar meant by McCarthy's motives being all about the Benjamin, she tweeted AIPAC, referring to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, an influential pro-Israel lobbying group that has spent millions sending lawmakers on visits to the Jewish nation over the years. What did Congresswoman Omar say or tweet that is anti-Semitic? Well, for insight, let's turn to my first guest. He's an attorney and executive director of STEM for Us. He is attorney Tlaib Karim. Tlaib, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Dr. Wilmer, I appreciate you having me on, and indeed a critically important topic at this particular time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. When you honestly look at the record, I have a problem understanding what it is that Congresswoman Tlaib got wrong. Help me out.
Well, I think that it's just the opposite. She got everything right. And so, as you know, in politics, when you get things too right, if you will, then you get dinged. And that's exactly what apparently happened to our sister Ilhan Omar today, and having to get the pressure to backtrack on her pretty accurate statements regarding the power of the Zionist lobby on Capitol Hill and throughout the country.
In a tweet today, she said, quote, anti-Semitism is real, and I'm grateful for Jewish allies and colleagues who are educating me on this painful history of anti-Semitic tropes, unquote. I agree with her. Anti-Semitism is real, and it is something that no one should tolerate, no one should support, and no one should defend. What I have found to occur in too many instances is any criticism of the Zionist policies of the Israeli government are immediately tagged as anti-Semitic, which I have found to be a weapon that is used to stifle analysis, commentary, and dissent.
Well, you're absolutely right. Let's just be clear and let's talk about recent facts, right? Well, last week, as you may know, Senate passed Senate Bill 1. Ironically, Senate Bill 1, that's the first Senate bill to be passed in this congressional session. And what did it have to do, or what was it about? It was about preventing average Americans from being able to express their First Amendment opposition to the apartheid system in Israel. As you may know, back in the 80s, many of our listeners may have been involved in the anti-apartheid movement of the 80s, which brought about the release of Nelson Mandela and ultimately the end of the apartheid system in South Africa. Well, what did they use? They used something that was innovative at the time, which was a campaign of boycotts, calling for divestment and sanctions. And the people of Palestine, who are experiencing some of the same types, in fact, in many cases, worse apartheid than they did experience back in the 80s, have now began to take a page from the 80s and use the same type of boycott, divestment, and sanctions that were successful. And they've now coined it BDS. And however, the Israeli government, which, as you may know, was the number one, right underneath the United States, that is, the number one supporter of the apartheid government of South Africa, they have seen that because it was so successful back in the 80s, they don't want to have the same success repeat itself. So now they are encouraging members of Congress to make it almost illegal for people to actually engage in that activity. And so that's what they did just 1 week ago. And now, again, this week, their next target is this small statured congresswoman who may be small in stature, but big in courage, at least.
Well, hang on. Before you go there, there's, I think, another important point that needs to be made. You correctly stated the oppression and the genocide that the Zionist government in Israel is imposing upon the people of Palestine, but you cannot leave out how Arabs who live in Israel are being treated by that Zionist government of Israel and what it means by law when that government considers itself now to be a Jewish state. We cannot leave those, in my opinion, incredibly important data points out of the conversation.
And, you know, a lot of people just think that it's a Muslim-Jewish controversy. Well, that's not the case. In fact, Christians in Palestine are subjected to the same type of apartheid oppression as our Muslims. This, again, a lot of folks don't know this. And so this is something that we absolutely must call out. And we must, again, acknowledge anybody, particularly members of Congress, who are willing to be brave enough and bold enough to speak out. And anytime they get national backlash from the likes of Chelsea Clinton, for example, and, you know, other members of Congress who have, again, called them to back their statements, back down from their statements, then we as the public must rally to their defense. And it's sad to see our sister Ilhan have to, again, backtrack on statements which were, you know, accurate, politically accurate. But that's how it works in Washington. We here in the public, we don't have the same type of, pressures can't be placed on us. I encourage everybody to celebrate what she said and to even go further.
Now, I think it's also very important to understand that by Congresswoman Omar making the comment, it's all about the Benjamins, her statement was immediately equated to an often used allegation or accusation that it's Jewish money that is controlling Hollywood and Jewish money that is controlling American media and Jewish money that is controlling American politics. We don't have to have that debate about the validity or the invalidity of that statement, because that's not what this conversation is about, and that's not what her statement was about. In December of 2018, for those who don't know, that was this past December, newly elected Congressional Representatives David Trone, Dan Crenshaw, Elaine Goodman Lauria, Tim Burchett, Denver Riggleman, Susie Lee, took an AIPAC-sponsored trip to Israel. AIPAC's educational arm spends about $10,000 per person on these trips. By using a nonprofit entity, AIPAC gets around a U.S. law intended to prohibit congressional junkets funded by lobbying groups. AIPAC does this, I think, just about every year. They send American members of Congress to Israel to indoctrinate them on the legislation that AIPAC deems relevant to their interests so that American lawmakers will act favorably on the side of AIPAC. That's not anti-Semitism. That's not my playing into the often used trope of Jewish money controls the world. That's fact. That's what AIPAC is doing, and that's where AIPAC is spending their money, and that's what AIPAC is expecting to get from their investment.
You may remember that 10 years ago, when the first Muslim member of Congress, the successor or the predecessor of Congresswoman Omar, was first elected, that is, former Congressman Keith Ellison, there was so much pressure because he, you know, was open about his faith. There was so much pressure placed on him as the first Muslim member of Congress that he himself was forced or compelled to go on that same trip that you just mentioned. Again, this speaking about the power of AIPAC, almost similar to the power of the gun lobby, you know, or the tobacco lobby in Congress. So what Congresswoman Omar spoke about, for those of us who, like myself, are former political operatives or current political operatives, former members of the staff of members of Congress, we know firsthand the power of that particular lobby. And, you know, to some extent, you know, in terms of, you know, the lobbying community, people admire their success. Now, if you happen to have a different perspective on, you know, the politics, you might say, well, they're successful, but they're not, you know, necessarily looking out for the best interests of the people. And I can also draw you to the overall global political conversation. As you may know, this upcoming week, there is going to be an assembly of nations who are aligning themselves against the nation of Iran. And this is being led by a coalition of pro-Israel or pro-Zionist factions, as well as, unfortunately, Arab nations who have reached an agreement in order to put pressure on, again, the people of Iran. Now, ironically, the same Iranian forces have been known to have been in support of the people of Palestine for years. So on the one hand, you have Muslims and Jews aligned against, again, Iran, and Iran aligning themselves with the people of Palestine. So it's a really, you know, complicated and complex both geopolitical conversation we're having, but as it relates to the you know, strength and courageousness of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, we can see that global issues have, you know, local and here national implications. And I just personally would like to, you know, salute her for being, first of all, bold enough to identify it, but perhaps savvy enough to some extent to try to mitigate the opposition that she was facing. But, you know, in the conclusion, say that we as the public, it's up to us when we see things such as this, even though our members of Congress and, you know, our leaders like Congresswoman Ilhan Omar may not be, you know, might not have the political might and may have more at stake. We don't have those things at stake. And so it's up to us to speak out and to stand with those who are willing to be courageous, like Congresswoman Omar, as well as Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who you may know, who replaced Congressman John Conyers. She organized an alternative to the AIPAC-funded junket that you mentioned.
Correct.
And for the first time, that was certainly courageous on her part as well.
Here's another question that has to be asked. And again, it's not anti-Semitic. It's actually American. Senator Ben Cardin, Senator Chuck Schumer, and a whole bunch of other senators back Senate Bill 1. Ben Cardin's an attorney. He went to law school. Chuck Schumer, he's an attorney. He went to law school. I think he went to Harvard. How can they back Senate Bill 1 that puts restrictions around an individual's First Amendment right to petition their government for grievances and redress of those grievances? How can those guys who, as I did in law school and you did in law school, took constitutional law your first semester in law school, right, not understand that Senate Bill 1 is in violation of our First Amendment rights of free speech and right to protest to the government to redress our grievances? And also, Senate Bill 1 has a provision that allows for $3.8 billion of our tax money per year to be sent to Israel for for military support, which I believe is in direct violation of the Arms Export Control Law. That's not anti-Semitic for me to raise these issues. It's the Constitution. It's American legislation. It's, as an American, my wanting to be sure that my tax dollars go where I want them to go and that there aren't laws passed by our Senate and our House that are in direct violation of our First Amendment rights. Help me out, Counselor Tlaib Kareem. I need legal advice here.
Well, the question you raised about the unconstitutionality of this bill is striking. I mean, for example, again, as a former chief counsel, it's almost impossible for you to get laws passed that are as clearly unconstitutional, meaning not even passed, but even introduced. The House or the Senate parliamentarian in this case would have or should have immediately, again, prevented that from even being introduced. But clearly there are pressures that were placed on this particular office that would normally have discounted that. But then one step further, I even posed that question, Dr. Leon. I posed that question directly to Senator Cardin.
Oh.
And last week, after, again, his vote. The response that I got from him, he said to me, well, I really did not support the anti-BDS bill. What I was really, doing was backing those who opposed the president's pullout of Syria and in Afghanistan. Now, again, those of us who know, Senator Cardin, we know that he was trying to fuzz.
I'm up against the clock. And so here's what I know. Here's why I know that Ben Cardin's statement is a lie, because Ben Cardin had written his own version of the bill. I want to say it was 2 years ago. It might have been last year. He wrote his own version of the bill, and in his version of the bill, he wanted to make it a felony for anybody that supported BDS in this country. He wanted to make it criminal and a felony to do so. So I know what he's saying is a lie.
You're absolutely right, Dr. Leon. And I'll just conclude by saying this. Those of us who are in support of the First Amendment right to protest, and those of us who, are respectful of the South anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, we are mobilizing in the state of Maryland to urge the governor or urge the Maryland General Assembly to reverse the governor's action, because again, Maryland was one of the first states to ban contracts to anyone who, again, engaged in this First Amendment-protected speech in protesting the apartheid system in Israel. And so we are mobilizing on the 25th of this month to, again, urge either the governor to back down from this unconstitutional act or to urge, again, members of the General Assembly to make, again, that nullified. And so if anybody wants any information about that, they can call me at the office at 202-508-3391, or check us out on Twitter at Tlaib Kareem Stem. And I salute you for being just so constantly courageous and bold and knowledgeable, Dr. Leon, and understanding that you can be a vocal critic of the apartheid system of Israel and not be an anti-Semite.
Tlaib Kareem, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly, greatly appreciate your insight and analysis. Look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Virginia Democrat backs off effort to open impeachment inquiry against Lieutenant Governor in Virginia Justin Fairfax. Virginia State Legislator Delegate Patrick Hope, who intended to begin impeachment proceedings against Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, backed off today after African-American lawmakers demanded there not be a rush to oust Fairfax, who is black, after accusations of sexual assault while the state's white governor and attorney general are refusing to resign after they admitted wearing blackface in their younger days. This situation in Virginia is getting more complex day by day. And to provide some insight and clarity, we turn to my next guests. First, he is an American scientist and the Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Biological Studies at the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanoengineering, which is jointly administered by North Carolina A&T and UNC Greensboro, Dr. Joseph Graves. Dr. Graves, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Again, stuff never stops. Every week.
That's why we got to call you, man. But we're also joined by a public historian. She focuses on African-American women and gender eugenics studies. She is the president and founder of the Acumen Group and author of In Search of Purity, Popular Eugenics and Racial Uplift Among New Negroes, Dr. Shantella Sherman. Shantella, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're also joined by Associate Vice President of Academic Affairs and Director of the International Programs at Mississippi Valley State University in Itabena, Mississippi. And she is Dr. Kathy Stromel Golden. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So Mr. Hope circulated a resolution on Sunday that would have directed a House committee to determine whether allegations of sexual assault against Fairfax by two women, Meredith Watson and Dr. Vanessa Tyson, quote, constitute conduct sufficient to provide grounds for impeachment, end quote. He said on Friday evening that he would introduce articles of impeachment today, Monday, if Fairfax, a fellow Democrat who denies the allegations, had not resigned by today. Let's start with Dr. Stromel Golden. Your thoughts on where we are right now in this incredibly complex situation in Virginia.
I think you hit it on the head. It's very complex. And I think what we have to think about in terms of this impeachment thing is, you know, with the Supreme Court nomination of Kavanaugh, with the president of the United States, have been accused numerous times of sexual misconduct. I think for me, it's important that Fairfax has a hearing or there's an investigation. You know, both deserve to be heard. And I think the fair way to do that is to have an investigation, to listen to his side, to listen to Dr. Tyson's side and Meredith and all of those things. And we still may not, you know, come to a conclusion that's acceptable. But I think I kind of agree, if you're going to rush to impeach him, then what do you do about the governor?
Dr. Graves, to Dr. Stromel Golden's point, a couple of things. One is we have a president who is an admitted sexual predator. We've seen the tape. We've heard the audio. He even advocates and extols the benefits of such. We have a president who has sexually objectified his own daughter publicly. And with that, we have white women who are saying Fairfax has got to go. But 58%, I think the number was, of white women voted to elect Donald Trump. So all I'm trying to get here is some consistency. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, I mean, I think on the question of public figures who've been engaged in sexual assault, and there's evidence that they've conducted sexual assault, those people need to resign their positions. And I would start with Donald Trump, who I would have resigned for a number of reasons, including what it may appear to be, if the evidence bears this out, treason against the United States. So, you know, we have a political leadership in this country that feels that it's above the law, that it can do whatever it wants, and in particularly against vulnerable populations, the way women have always been in this society. So If the evidence merits it, and in the case of Donald Trump, I mean, I think the evidence is incontrovertible concerning his sexual assaults and sexual predator behavior. For the lieutenant governor in Virginia, again, I haven't seen all the evidence, and I don't know that all the evidence has come to light yet, but should that evidence indicate that he's guilty of sexual assault, then he should definitely resign.
Dr. Sherman, American history is replete with examples of African-American men being lynched based upon allegations of rape. And I don't think that it's out of bounds to take that historical reality into account when we do our analysis. You can't, in my opinion, assess this in an ahistorical context. Am I wrong for saying that?
Not at all. And in the same vein, we have a history of white males who have conducted themselves as sexual predators openly, whether it's through mob violence and rape, assault, and did so understanding that they would never be brought to trial. And so that's what you're seeing, is that double standard. Right now, I think that Virginia is going through its own internal civil war, where they're trying to reconcile the law and the morality with their elected officials. But this is something, that good old boys type of mentality, above the law, beyond reproach. And if no one will stop them and say something, then you will always have that duplicitous type of mindset where even though it's bad, it may be okay for these white guys, these older white men, to get away with this. But when it's a black male, absolutely not, because it signals that you're allowing criminals to get away with things. There's a different brush that's used to stoke that flame, and at the same time to paint this man as a savage and this, before you've heard all the evidence. We have, you know, the evidence on Donald Trump, but it's not actually being used to go ahead and impeach him. And so there is this double standard that needs to be looked at. And I think that it was a good idea to pull that indictment back.
Dr. Stromel Golden, what about the reality that we're now seeing here? It seems as though the Democrats have thought about this in the larger political context, realizing if they throw the governor out, if they throw the lieutenant governor out, and if they throw the attorney general out, they have now just turned over the state of Virginia to Republicans, and they've probably wound up doing it for a time longer than anybody can imagine. So what about just the political context of the decisions that are being made now?
I think it's important for them to think about this, because, you know, we talk about the gains that Virginia has made, and all of that to be undone in one fatal swoop is very complicated. And I think, you know, if you talk about the intersection of race, gender, politics, it's a really complicated, complex situation. And I think people have to give a lot of thought to that. You know, some of the polls I was looking at yesterday show that a majority of African-American polls said let the governor stay in. I think in that case, one might think about, they are thinking about where they hold rather than individually. While they individuals may want to see him out, then they think about the reality of what happens if you have all three of those men out. So I think in terms of community and what's best for the whole, maybe that's why we see the numbers. Of course, I don't know what part of the states they were polled from and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a very complicated situation, and there are no easy answers.
Dr. Graves, it's now being reported that four staffers working for the lieutenant governor have quit their jobs. A series of staffers working for Justin Fairfax, either in his government office or his political action committee, have resigned. His policy director, Adele McClure, and scheduler, Julia Billingsley, both quit effective this past Friday, as did two employees of his We Rise Together political action committee, David Mills and Courtney McCargo, according to his spokeswoman, Lauren Burke. Now we have staff leaving the organization.
Well, my view is that he has to face the music. And these allegations are serious allegations. They can't be ignored. And so if in fact he is innocent, then he needs to move to clear his name. And if he can't do that, if he's lost the confidence of the people who work for him, then he's going to be ineffective anyway, and he needs to resign so that someone can come in who can do the job effectively.
Dr. Chantella Sherman, there are those who have compared this, and Dr. Stromel Golden did this earlier mentioning Kavanaugh. But I've been telling people, yeah, I can understand your comparisons here between Kavanaugh and Fairfax, but remember, we now call Kavanaugh Justice Kavanaugh for a reason. Is this a matter of weathering the storm, or are we rushing to judgment? Are we looking to throw a guy overboard with all the Me Too conversation and all of that?
Whatever the underlying issues may be, he does need to face his accusers. And I think that it's appropriate that that goes forward one way or the other. With all of the other tensions, like I said, that Virginia is going through at this point, I think as voters, this is something that we actually need to take into consideration when we're starting to pull together who we want to run for election. I think that, you know, one of the reasons for this pullback is that if you went through Capitol Hill and these charges are leveled, half of Capitol Hill, more than half, would really be looking back into their past trying to figure out, can I be next? Would I be next? Who in my past have I done X, Y, and Z to that was not quite right, technically wrong, illegal, potentially damaging? We aren't thinking about this. These allegations came forward in 2000 and 2004 with Fairfax. So, you know, my issue at this point, if there really is an issue with it, because I don't think there should be a statute necessarily of limitations, but this information was readily available and out there this entire time throughout these men's careers, whether it was the sexual assaults or the blackface. That information wasn't necessarily hidden. It was there. So there's a timing issue with this as well. That's quite suspicious to me. But however it comes out, whenever it comes out, this man needs to face his accusers, and we need to just deal with that. The comparison sometimes just makes us run in circles.
I think you're absolutely right. I do agree he does need to face his accusers. And what we have to understand here, a couple of things. One, if this information had come out during the campaign and voters decided to use this information as part of their assessment of who they would vote for, that makes perfect sense. But now we have a person who is now, they're trying to throw him out of his job based upon allegations. In a country where there is a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. So for me, this isn't a matter of Me Too. This isn't a matter of whether those accusers are right or wrong. It's a matter of we have a standard in this country that needs to be followed. We should not have exceptions in terms of when we choose and how we choose to follow those systems and those processes. Dr. Joseph Graves, Dr. Chantella Sherman, Dr. Kathy Stromel Golden, thank you all for your time and thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. 40 years ago today, Iranians engaged in a bloodless revolution. They overthrew Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Western-backed dictator, also known as the Shah. This revolution made me reflect upon Mohammad Mossadegh, the 35th prime minister of Iran, holding office from 1951 to 1953, when his government was overthrown in a coup d'etat orchestrated by the US CIA and the United Kingdom's MI6. Anglo-American Oil Company did not like, among other things, that Mossadegh was nationalizing Iranian oil and trying to raise the price per barrel so that he could raise the standard of living for the average Iranian. Sounds a lot like what the U.S. is trying to do in Venezuela. So I decided to reach out to some greater minds than mine to discuss this. My first guest, former professor in Temple University's African American Studies Department and an expert on the writings of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois and an international activist, world-renowned Dr. Anthony Montero. Dr. Montero, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much, Wilmer. Good to be with you.
We're also joined by Phil Wagliato, a writer, speaker, and organizer based in Richmond, Virginia. He's a founding member of the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, and all-volunteer community organization, and editor of the quarterly newspaper, The Virginia Defender. Phil, did I pronounce your name properly?
No.
Help me out, please.
But you got wide company. It's Wileto.
Wileto. Thank you, sir. I apologize and thank you for the correction. Phil, I know your time is short, so let me start with you. Looking back upon the 1953 coup d'etat in Iran, is that a fair comparison between what the U.S. is now attempting to do in Venezuela?
Well, it was the first foreign coup orchestrated by the CIA. And the key figure there was Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, who directed it from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
As well as Norman Schwarzkopf Sr.
Yes, exactly. Don't want to forget Storm and Norman's old man.
There you go.
But there's parallels in that the CIA fomented tensions and conflicts in the street by hiring people to demonstrate. In those days, it was a little cruder. Sometimes they weren't even concerned that they were demonstrating for or against Prime Minister Mousadegh, just so long as there was trouble going on. And they tried to buy off some newspaper editors and some religious figures. So in that sense, sure, there's parallels. But the operation that's going on in Venezuela today is far more sophisticated. It builds on another coup, which took place just 5 years ago this month, which was the one in Ukraine, where there was the role of the NGOs, the non-government organizations, particularly those funded by George Soros's Open Society Foundation, as well as $5 billion. Which the U.S. government admits to having poured into the pro-democracy organization, so-called, in Ukraine, which laid the basis for building an anti-government opposition that was really promoting market reforms and deregulation of industry and cutbacks in social services and attacks on pension rights and so on. So you can see how this develops from what would be viewed today as a somewhat crude intervention in Iran to a more increasingly more sophisticated color revolutions in Eastern Europe up to the 2014 coup in Ukraine. And now what is you have to give them credit. This is a well-thought-out propaganda campaign, a promotion of what looks to the outside world like a pro-democracy movement, crippling sanctions and financial manipulations, which cause real harm to the economy, and then Washington blaming those dire economic conditions on mismanagement, corruption, and the socialist model. So they've learned a great deal. Unfortunately, during this period, the anti-war movement has shrunk, and for many, many reasons, and a lot of people are not getting an alternative view of what is happening. Fortunately, and this is the last point I wanted to make, there are protests that have erupted across the country. They've been going on for several days now. There's a big push for activities around February 23rd, and you could go online and look at Hands Off Venezuela to find out what is happening. There's another major march scheduled in Washington, D.C. for March 16th. And then the anti-war coalition that my group is affiliated with, the United National Anti-War Coalition, is sponsoring a major national march in Washington, D.C. on March 30th that will address the situation in Venezuela, the continuing oppression of the Palestinian people, and most directly, the 70th anniversary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which will be celebrated by all the foreign ministers in that alliance in Washington, D.C. on April 4th.
Dr. Montero, same question to you. My comparison between the U.S.-backed coup in Iran and the U.S. attempted U.S.-backed coup in Venezuela, is this an apt comparison?
Well, I think in a broad sense it is, but I think each event has to be considered within the time frame, the historical time frame that it occurs. I think in 1953, the forces of imperialism were far more powerful than they are today. I think the other thing, in the case of the overthrow of Mossadegh, the Iranian people, unlike in 1979, had not fully taken state power. And even though you had a relatively progressive and reform government in Mossadegh, you still had the 2,500-year-old dynasty in power. Now, when you think about Venezuela today, the struggle is not just to overturn a government, but to, through a counter-revolution, assume state power, to break up the Chavista, if you will, state, and replace it with a neoliberal state compliant to the wishes of the United States and its Western allies. However, the Iranian Revolution, 40 years on, is stronger than it was in 1979. In fact, stronger than it was during the time of the Iran-Iraq War, and is diplomatically, politically, and economically a major power, if not the major power, in what is called the Middle East. So in many ways, the Iranian Revolution has won. Its enemies in the United States and certain European capitals, as well as Israel and Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, have lost. On the other side, the Venezuelan Revolution is under attack. But from what I can see, the forces of state power remain in the hands of the Chavistas, the revolutionary forces, the Bolivarian forces, and the Socialist Unity Party has, I think, the support of the majority of the people. Certainly, the majority of people in huge numbers, I think 86%, oppose any form of foreign intervention into their domestic affairs and oppose sanctions, these tightening sanctions. The other thing, and I'll end on this, when nations like Russia and China are joined with Iran and Turkey and Mexico and Uruguay and even Italy to a certain extent in opposing this U.S. ill-conceived attempt to intimidate and overthrow the government and regime in Venezuela, we see something quite different. At a certain point, I think we can talk about the beleaguered dollar and such, and how Venezuela it has means to go around dollar hegemony in its trade and foreign economic financial efforts.
Phil, I know your time is very limited. Do you have time for one more question?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Back in 53, it was Anglo-American Oil in Iran. Now in Venezuela, it's ExxonMobil trying to get access to the Venezuelan oil reserves. You have now the U.S. through Pompeo and Bolton basically backing a play that they see as being fairly simple and something that they can pull off fairly quickly. They wind up going to the UN and finding out that the UN, because of, as Tony talked about, China and Russia opposition, this thing isn't going to play out as simply as they thought. So here we are now with the Iranian Revolution 40 years later. Do you see a similarly protracted struggle in Venezuela that the United States still finds itself embroiled in as it deals with Iran?
Well, embroiled. I mean, the problem with the tensions between the U.S. and Iran is that the U.S. won't leave Iran alone. The U.S. isn't stuck in any kind of a quagmire in relation to Iran. It's the aggressor.
Correct.
All it has to do is
Correct.
Back off. In Venezuela, what the tactic is now is to, as you know, stockpile quote unquote humanitarian supplies and food on the Colombia side of the Colombia-Venezuela border, and call on the Venezuelan military to allow this aid to be brought into the country, and presumably distributed by the opposition. And the purpose of this is not to bring in any kind of humanitarian aid. If they wanted to help the people of Venezuela, all they would have to do is end the sanctions and the financial manipulations. But it's to try to split the support for the Maduro government by appealing to a section of the military to go against the government's orders, allow the humanitarian aid in, and then they've been promised amnesty by the shadow government. That's a very sophisticated tactic and designed to get sympathy, you know, world sympathy behind what is really a setup situation. But what the U.S. is doing is assuming that the only real support that President Maduro has is the military. And in Venezuela, there are several million people who belong to popular militias armed by the government and ready to defend its government. So that is why President Maduro can promise a new Vietnam if there is an actual invasion of the country. I would like to think that as right-wing as they are, there are some people in the U.S. military who are smart enough to recognize that this would make Vietnam look like a tea party. And with Russia and China objecting to the U.S. Aggression against Venezuela, as difficult as the situation is, I think there's hope that Maduro can stay in power and the Venezuelan people can be free to determine their own destiny, safe from imperialist intervention. But let's hope and let's do what we can in this country to raise our voices to hold back the U.S. policies there.
Phil Wiljedo, thank you very much for your time. Again, I know your time is short. Greatly appreciate you coming to and contributing to the Critical Hour. Looking forward to having you back.
Thanks so much for having me on today. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you. Tony, the same question to you. We start in 1953. Here we are. The United States is still, to Phil's point, still engaged in Iran because we just keep picking this fight and won't let it go. It was Anglo-American oil then. It's ExxonMobil now in Venezuela. You know, what are we learning from this movie that we've seen time and time again? And then your thoughts on, to Phil's point, what I'm calling the weaponization of food distribution in Venezuela.
Yeah. I would agree. Just to start with your last point, it is an attempt to weaponize food. But again, to me, this seems more like a joke than anything else. You know, Maduro has announced that hundreds of thousands of more Venezuelans will be armed. A government that is afraid of its people does not arm its people.
Great point, Tony.
Yes. The other point is that the Venezuelan army is carrying out military exercises on its borders, particularly with Colombia, in defense of its territory. The other thing is, you know, we don't know what the political situation in Colombia is. Certainly, it is a country that only recently got out of a very, very long, 40-year-long civil war, and it is not a united country. Certainly, there are forces within the FARC and other organizations, guerrilla organizations and political organizations, who would oppose any use of Colombian territory. to attack Venezuela. The other thing is that the Russians have made it clear that they will make certain military hardware and personnel available to the Venezuelan army, and in particular to the Venezuelan Air Force. And the last point I would make, and I think we cannot underestimate the fact that the U.S. financial weapons, the use of the dollar, is not what it used to be. It is not the potent weapon that it used to be, because increasingly countries like Russia and Venezuela and Iran and China are trading with one another outside of the dollar hegemony or the dollar itself. This is highly significant. I am of the opinion, I know I'm spending a lot of time on Venezuela.
No, and you're good.
Yes, that this is a gift politically to Marco Rubio and the counter-revolutionaries from Venezuela and other parts of South America in South Florida. It is as much about the 2020 election and the Florida electoral votes as anything. It is going to fail. We talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
They went to the UN Security Council and suddenly they face a situation the direct opposite of what they confronted in 2011 when they went to get the resolution for a no-fly zone in Libya. I think this is highly significant. But I also see a growing international solidarity between countries that are sanctioned by the United States. For example, Venezuela and Iran, Venezuela and Russia. We cannot forget that there are stiff sanctions on Russia, U.S. sanctions on Russia. The other thing is that the Europeans are not going along with the U.S. sanctions against Iran. For example, a week and a half ago, Germany, France, and Britain set up what they call the non-dollar trade instrument in support of trade, which is a way of their continuing trade with Iran outside of the use of the dollar. This is highly significant because, you know, the Trump administration withdrew from the nuclear deal, which it had been a part of with several European countries, and said that it would punish those European companies and countries that traded with Iran. Well, what the Europeans have done is to set up a way to trade with Iran without using the dollar.
Quickly to that point, Tony, that I've been reading, they're now investigating, if not employing, cryptocurrency.
Well, wow. This is highly significant because all of these events, Wilmer, occur within the framework of a decline in the dollar hegemony. Some would even suggest a not-so-distant collapse of the dollar as the dominant world currency in finance and trade. The other thing we have to consider in all of this, the war weariness mm-hmm. of the American people.
Yes.
The austerity weariness of the American people. There is, and I haven't seen any polls on this, but it does not seem to me that there's any enthusiasm among the American population for another regime change type of war, this time in South America. Nor does there seem to be a great deal of enthusiasm for a war with Iran, even in spite of all of the propaganda
mm-hmm, and the rhetoric
coming from Israel and from the Israeli supporters in the political system in this country.
Let me stop you there. Dr. Anthony Montero, as always, man, thank you so much for that insight and analysis. I appreciate you coming on board. And again, thanks to Phil Wiliato in Richmond, Virginia, for contributing as well. Tony, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Will.
All right. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.